Thanks very much, Stephen. Happy to be here tonight to talk to you all. Okay. Sorry, I just got to ask the technology. Do I do that? Yeah. Okay. So it's just over 10 years since the date that people most associate with the financial crisis, which is the 15th of September, which was the day that Lehman's filed for bankruptcy. There have been quite a number of articles written in recent months looking back at that time and the period leading up to it. So it's interesting to read the different perspectives on the same set of events, especially those that recount events that I had a ringside seat at or was even in the ring itself. As I've said recently, it's a bit like the standard line about the 60s that those who can remember the GFC probably weren't there. The sleep-deprived haze that was pervasive at the time affects the memory, certainly affects my memory. Critical decisions were made under extreme duress and fatigue, particularly in the US, although they do by and large stack up well with the passage of time. Today, I'm not going to give another detailed account of what happened. You can read about that elsewhere. I will talk instead about some of the events, but the main thing I intend to do is to talk about some of the lessons learned and relearned from the crisis. I will also discuss some questions that arise from the crisis that remain unresolved, at least in my mind. And they are questions which I think should be a focus of the economics profession. Answering them will help guide policymakers should be faced with similar situations to the one we confronted in 2008. So the key lesson that comes from the crisis that I will highlight today, or talk about today, is that leverage really matters. Leverage significantly magnifies the effect of any shock that hits the economy. Leverage might not start the fire, but it will pour petrol on a burning platform. But at the same time, you need to keep the credit flowing to prevent the economy from seizing up. So, okay, so this is where I'm going. So these are the titles of the things I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to start with The Ballad of a Thin Man. Then Everything Flows, which is about the plumbing. Then Karma Police, which is the FSB. Or the Royal Commission. How much is enough? And then finally talk about history never repeating. So let me start with Ballad of a Thin Man, which some of you hopefully know the lyrics of this song, because that's where I'm starting. So one of the most famous line in this song goes like this: "Something's happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?" So that's basically Bob Dylan's asking the same question that the Queen asked a bunch of economists 10 years ago. Why didn't anyone see this coming? So there are those who saw the storm clouds on the horizon, and Michael Lewis wrote a best-selling book about some of those people. But often the storm didn't actually quite take the form that those people were expecting. So a bunch of people said they saw it, maybe, but they didn't actually see it unfolding the way it actually did unfold. Very few appreciated the extent of the financial interconnectedness and what that actually implied. For example, one common prediction was that there would be a US dollar crash with consequent calamity. That was actually one of the main predictions. There's a crisis coming and the US dollar is going to go through the floor. So what happened? The crisis came, US dollar went through the roof. So didn't quite get that one right. So a lot of people said they saw it coming, but it didn't quite turn out quite the way they expected. A number of people said they saw it coming, didn't quite go the way they thought. So let's look back on how financial markets reacted through 2007. So the onset of the crisis is often dated from BNP shutting three funds with subprime mortgage exposure on the 9th of August. So that caused a short-lived wobble in equity markets, but after that it was onwards and upwards for much of the rest of the year, with the equity market actually peaking in November 2007. The equity market was the lens through which a lot of the public saw the events unfold, so by that metric 2007 was actually pretty benign. Macroeconomists generally looked at what was unfolding in the US housing market and expected that its spillover to the rest of the economy and the rest of the world would be contained. Indeed, the slowdown would be mild and to an extent welcome in containing the inflationary pressures that have been building. But the fixed income market took fright in August 2007 and got more and more scared throughout the rest of the year. Uncertainty increased about the quality and value of asset-backed securities and the assets that underpinned them. There was further uncertainty about whose books these assets actually resided on. UBS thought they'd sold a whole bunch of mortgage-backed securities. Turns out they'd sold it to themselves. They weren't alone in that. There were other institutions in this room who did the same. they were one of the best examples of that, generating a marked rise in counterparty risk aversion amongst financial institutions. That is, institutions became less willing to lend to each other, both because of concerns about the financial strength of the counterparty, as well as a desire to hoard any available liquidity because they thought they might need it themselves. So the standard summary graph of the crisis, or if you want one thing to see how the crisis is unfolding, this is the one that most people go with, which is the LIBOR spread over the expected Fed funds rate, or the Australian equivalent is the BBSWRIS spread. And that and you can pretty much date most or see most events unfolding through this prism. So as I said, the fixed income market, you can see there, started to get frightened in the middle of 2007, and then it got progressively worse. The tensions continued to increase with a rolling series of flare-ups, including notably the rescue of Bear Stearns by JP Morgan in March 2008. And by that stage, these concerns were increasingly reflected in the equity market too. So into 2008, GDP growth in a number of economies had started to slow, but it was not until the fourth quarter of 2008 when the economic forces took hold with a vengeance. So Lehman filed on the Monday morning Australian time. It's actually interesting to look back at what happened on that day. It was actually a pretty quiet one in financial markets that day. So Lehman's is often dated as the event of the crisis. It was actually a pretty quiet day in markets. Lehman's wasn't the turning point. It actually got worse after that. So the actual zenith of the crisis was still to come in the following weeks. So AIG, which is the poster child of financial connectedness, was rescued. TARP was rejected by Congress and then passed after financial tumult broke out. The Prime Mutual Fund Reserve broke the buck. Washington Mutual failed. And that's just the sort of edited highlights of what happened over those subsequent weeks. Markets were driven by fear with huge swings in prices. Many of these swings occurred late in the New York trading day, which was early in the Australian day. The correlation between the Australian dollar and the US equity markets through those times was indicative of the extremely high degree of co-movement across all markets. If you have a look back, it was basically a correlation of one. Markets regularly recorded, to quote, 25 standard deviation events, which was the words that then Goldman CFO David Vinier used. Just to put it in perspective, 25 standard deviation events are only supposed to happen once in the lifetime of the universe. That's what, from a statistical point of view, that means, which says something about the risk models that were being used at the time. So my recollection of the worst of it was in the early hours of Saturday morning on the 11th of October. We'd been intervening in the foreign exchange market throughout the Friday evening Australian time, to provide liquidity to an almost completely illiquid market. So talking on the phone at some 1 or 2 in the morning to the RBA desk in New York, they reported that US Treasuries that day, which is arguably the most liquid market in the world, had effectively seized up. So it's worth just remembering that, just to recall how dislocative and disruptive these developments were. It really was not clear how this was going to end, except badly. And indeed, the fourth quarter of 2008 was bad. So this is the graph of GDP in levels terms. So in the fourth quarter of 2008, global GDP declined by 1.5%. GDP in the US fell by 2.25%. And in Australia, GDP contracted by 0.5%. The impact was particularly severe in global trade. So this is the level of global trade. So you can see the fourth quarter of 2008, which global trade basically collapsed as trade finance dried up because of extreme counterparty risk aversion. Companies and banks were unwilling to accept the guarantee of another bank that underpinned the trade lines of credit. They had little confidence they were going to get paid. So the breadth and depth of the impact was remarkable. So output fell by more in the Great Depression than it did here, but the Great Depression was not synchronised nor as widespread as this was. And these macro and financial developments very much underpin the nature of the global policy response, both monetary and fiscal. There was a fiscal response in many, although not all, countries, buttressed by the G20 leaders meeting in April 2009. Central banks responded by reducing policy rates rapidly to very low levels, and some of those actions were coordinated in a hitherto unprecedented manner. Central bank balance sheets expanded rapidly. So I've got here central bank balance sheet is just indexed, so it's not as a share of GDP, it's just the size of their balance sheets in terms of total assets from the beginning of 2008, and you can see the rapid expansion in 2008 of the Fed's balance sheet and the ECB's balance sheet and the Bank of England's balance sheet in particular. So the re-intermediation by central banks mitigated withdrawal of intermediation by the banking sector. So in the last quarter of 2008, the banks have just completely pulled back from intermediation and the central banks stepped in. Central banks were willing to stand between institutions that were unwilling to deal with each other, as well as accommodate the rapid increase in demand for liquidity. That large increase in central bank balance sheets mitigated the large contraction in the financial sector, which goes a long way to explaining why it is still yet to lead to a marked rise in inflation, despite that being foreshadowed by a number of commentators over the past decade. So quite famously, there was a joint letter written by a whole bunch of people saying that the Fed's balance sheet expansion was basically going to lead to hyperinflation. Still haven't quite got there yet. The central bank actions were designed to alleviate the credit crunch. An alphabet soup of programs was implemented in the US to address the dysfunction in the number of markets, with similar programs in other countries. The aim was to keep the credit flowing and limit the need for fire sales wherever possible. So an important motivation for this first phase of quantitative easing in the US and elsewhere was addressing that market dysfunction. Indeed, for a time, the Fed actually characterised what it was doing as credit easing. This first phase of QE was particularly effective. My view is that subsequent phases of QE have had diminishing returns, although I acknowledge that much of the empirical evidence tends not to find that. A question worth considering about QE is, if QE was effective on the way in, then surely there must be a large degree of symmetry. Hence, we should expect to see similar but opposite effects on the way out, which, as you can see there, is what's happening now in the US. If there were diminishing returns to QE, then it might take a little while before we see the full impact of the reduction in the Fed's balance sheet that is currently underway, but the effect should grow over time. Turning to Australia, why did Australia come through the crisis better than many other countries? There are a number of contributing factors. Good luck certainly played a role, but the policy actions made an important contribution too. Monetary policy was eased rapidly. The Australian banking system was much less affected by the problems bedevilling banking systems in other countries, and that was partly through good luck, as much as some people might say it was good management. This meant that the transmission of the significant easing in monetary policy to the economy worked pretty much as normal here. The exchange rate depreciation combined with the fact that the Australian economy could adapt flexibly to the depreciation, that was also beneficial. Fiscal stimulus in Australia, in my view, was absolutely necessary and was a critical factor behind Australia's good economic outcomes. While one can argue about the exact nature of the implementation, the fact that it was designed to take effect quickly was vital in the circumstances. Go hard, go early, go to households, is the way Ken Henry put it. China was certainly a major contributor to Australia's resiliency, but it is important to remember that China's strong growth at the time was a direct consequence of their large fiscal stimulus. So it seems inconsistent to me to argue that China saved Australia as a result of its fiscal stimulus while simultaneously dismissing the direct impact of fiscal stimulus here. So what lessons did we learn and relearn from this experience on the policy front? Policy capacity matters, both monetary and fiscal. Fiscal space is really important. We still have that in Australia. It is less clear there is fiscal capacity in some other countries. Monetary capacity matters too. So while the Reserve Bank, we have repeatedly said that our expectation is that the next move in monetary policy is more likely up than down, though some way off, should that turn out not to be the case, there is still scope for further reductions in the policy rate. It is the level of interest rates that matter, and they still can move lower. We have also been able to examine the experience of others with other tools of monetary policy and have learned from that. Hopefully, we won't ever have to put that learning into practice. QE is a policy option in Australia, should it be required. There are less government bonds here than elsewhere, which may make QE more effective, although most of the traction, in terms of borrowing rates in Australia is at the front end of the curve rather than the back end of the curve, which might reduce the effectiveness of QE. Our balance sheet can also expand to help reduce upward pressure on funding if necessary, as occurred in 2008. And finally, a floating exchange rate matters and remains an important shock absorber for the Australian economy. So having just gone through the sort of policy side of things, let me step into the plumbing a bit and talk about the flow of credit. And I'll talk briefly about the lessons learned on liquidity provision and other measures undertaken to keep financial markets functioning as best as possible. So our balance sheet, as I showed a minute ago, expanded in Australia for a number of reasons. Increasing repo at term to the banks helped to provide some additional certainty to bank funding and mitigate some of the upward pressure on bank funding costs. More generally, the balance sheet of the central bank and that of the public sector has the capacity to intertemporally smooth more than any other balance sheet in the economy, be it financial institutions, corporates or households. The capacity to do this is particularly important when you're dealing with a systemic risk event, as was the case in the GFC. The central bank can intermediate extreme counterparty risk, functioning as much as intermediary of last resort, as much as lender of last resort. Another example of this was the provision of the FX swap lines. These facilities were introduced to address the global shortage of US dollars outside the US, which was causing a substantial dislocation in swap markets. In our case, we were able to intermediate the provision of US dollars into the Asian time zone where this shortage was particularly acute. By the end of the trading day in the US, these shortages has often abated, but they started the day in our time zone with a particular shortage of US dollars. The swap lines were not about providing US dollars to the Australian banks to meet US dollar obligations. The Australian banks were predominantly funding Australian dollar assets, and the hedges on their US dollar borrowings provided them with the US dollars as these matured. They needed Australian dollars, not US dollars. On the 12th of October, the government introduced the guarantee on wholesale debt and deposits, and that followed from the introduction of the guarantee in Ireland on the 30th of September. So with the guarantee in place in many other countries, Australian banks would have been at a significant disadvantage in terms of funding costs without the guarantee and market access. The guarantee allowed the banks to access another group of investors who at this point had an appetite only for sovereign credit, not for bank credit. It's interesting to consider the question of how much the guarantee addressed the issue of quantity or price. So there was a period of time when debt markets were closed at any price, and that was in the last quarter of 2008 for sure. But at some point, it became more an issue of price rather than quantity. So you could get it away, but it was going to cost you. As an indication of the price that might have had to have been paid, Goldman's issued a bond early in 2009 at a spread of 500 basis points over. It's considerably more than they normally pay. It's also worth noting that short-term funding continued to be issued by the Australian banks without the need for guarantee. So after a period, I think it was certainly the case that the guarantee was very about getting quantity done more at a reasonable price. The RBA operations and the government's funding guarantee were priced such that usage would decline as market conditions improved, and indeed, that's what happened. The many Fed facilities introduced to address market dysfunction were priced the same way. And that is an important lesson which has been around since the time of Badger. These facilities were introduced to facilitate the flow of credit to the real economy at a reasonable price, and in some cases alleviate the need for asset fire sales, which have the capacity to tip markets and the economy into an even worse equilibrium. It is also worth noting that the depreciation in the exchange rate also helped out on the funding side. So with a lower exchange rate, a given amount of US dollar funding translates into more Australian dollars to fund Australian dollar assets. Unlike in some countries, the maturity match hedging of the Australian bank's offshore funding meant that there was no issue of currency mismatch. Indeed, the CSAs associated with those hedges actually provided the short-term source of additional funding. And if you read the speech, you can find out how exactly that works. Finally, the similarity of the business models of the Australian banks was probably beneficial in the GFC. There was not much to differentiate between them, which meant that the counterparty uncertainty present in other banking systems was nowhere near as prevalent here. The Australian bank similarity is not so obviously beneficial in the current circumstance. Their similar behaviour and similar reactions functions to events such as falling house prices runs the risk of amplifying the downturn in the housing market. The crisis very much demonstrated the critical importance of keeping the lending flowing. The lesson is that countries that did that fared better than countries that didn't. That lesson is relevant to the situation today in Australia, where there is a risk that a reduced appetite to lend will overly curtail borrowing with consequent effects for the Australian economy. So let me now turn to the regulatory response to the crisis, which has been coordinated under the auspices of the Financial Stability Board. So in the banking space, the regulation has included the Basel capital standards, which required the banks to hold more capital, thereby reducing leverage, the LCR to reduce liquidity or runnable funding, to increase liquidity and reduce runnable funding, the NSFR, which has addressed funding mismatch and maturity transformation, and then not so much here, but in the US, the Volcker rule, and increased balance sheet costs more generally, which have reduced banks' capacity to provide services such as market making in other jurisdictions. The capital requirements have clearly reduced the leverage in the core banking system. Some argue that that leverage should be reduced further, but unambiguously, banks hold more capital now than they did pre-crisis. The enhanced liquidity regulation in Australia has been in place since the beginning of 2015, and its effects have been present even before then, as the banks adjusted their funding and assets to meet the new requirements. In other parts of the world, I think the effect of the liquidity regulation has been diluted by the large liquidity provided by the greatly expanded central bank balance sheets. We don't have that situation here. As the Fed's balance sheet is shrinking, it is likely that the liquidity regulation will start to bite more in the US. Indeed, I think we are starting to see some effects now, not necessarily in aggregate, but at least in particular parts of the money markets. As important as the liquidity regulation is, in my view, asset quality is ultimately what matters more than funding. If asset quality remains sound, as a creditor of a bank, I should be confident of being repaid. So let me give you an example of how this might play out, or how this did play out. And that's to compare the German domestic banks with the Australian banks. So the German domestic banks were predominantly deposit funded. No wholesale funding, all deposit funding. However, with relatively low returns on offer in Germany, they sought out high yielding assets offshore, including US RMBS, CDOs, and other exotic assets. In contrast, the Australian banks utilised more wholesale funding, but were able to earn high returns on their domestic Australian assets. During the crisis, the German banks were faced with much greater asset quality issue than the Australian banks. They had large US dollar asset positions that were difficult to fund in the market, notwithstanding the fact that their funding in euros is generally regarded as more stable. Let me turn to the Volcker rule for a bit and talk about the fact that banks have retreated from their former role as market makers and risk warehouses. So that was by design. That was the intent of the Volcker rule, to ensure that the core part of the intermediation process would not be affected by concerns about the quality of the assets on the bank's books accumulated through their market-making activities, and particularly given the difficulty in distinguishing between risk warehousing and speculation, which can often be quite observationally equivalent. So what does this imply for market making, for market dynamics, sorry? So the change in the impact of the Volcker rule has meant that it's distributing the risk from the banking sector to real money, such as asset managers. So instead of the risk sitting on the books of the banks, it's sitting on the books of asset managers. That's fine in principle, as asset managers have much more capacity to absorb and manage the risk with less disruption to the real economy. But it still remains an open question as to how quickly people with deployable capital respond to dislocations in market prices, given that banks play a considerably smaller role today. That said, one should be careful not to look at the past with rose-coloured glasses. Banks didn't rush in to catch a falling knife when asset prices were falling in the past. Liquidity pockets occurred at least as much in the past, with one good example being the frequency of large big-figure movements in foreign exchange rates. Just like to note that exchange rates need to go down by a bit more than 50 basis points to be labelled a plummet. Just for editorial guidance. So back in the day, they used to go by a bit more than that on a regular basis. Bid-ask spreads used to widen a lot in the past too, and the ultimate widening in bid-ask spreads back in the day was actually just to not answer the phone. In addition, the market liquidity provision mechanism now is much more machines and less people. The shape of liquidity has changed, and with it, market dynamics in a stress environment. So the potential volatility of markets has increased, even though actual volatility has generally been low. In such circumstances, some have talked about central bankers acting as market maker of last resort, stepping in to provide liquidity in a dislocated market, much like foreign exchange intervention. So that's an interesting question to consider. I think it's a mischaracterisation to call that market making. It is more likely the central bank will be the buyer of last resort, not the market maker of last resort. It may well be some time before the central bank can actually sell on the asset at a reasonable price. Now, that may well be fine to prevent fire-style dynamics taking hold, but it should be recognised for what it is, which is not market making. The potential implications for central bank balance sheets in such circumstances also need to be thought through. So on the regulatory front, one lesson from any number of crises past is that it is almost inevitable the next crisis will originate somewhere different. The inevitability of this in part arises because of the reforms introduced to address the sources of the previous crisis. So we saw what happened last time, put in reforms to address that, sorted that out, it's probably going to occur somewhere else. So where might one possible location of the next crisis lie? To me, one possibility is that it will involve central counterparties, or CCPs. So they have a high degree of interconnectedness, considerably greater than before, and very much sit at the heart of the financial system today. Their resilience is of first order importance as they potentially can constitute single points of failure. So much has been done to increase their resilience, but it remains a work in progress. Let me move on to ask a question via Mr. Tim Rogers, which is how much is enough? So what we don't know is what is the right amount of leverage in the system. When is there too much? So I said right up front, leverage was at the heart of the GFC. Leverage in the banking system and highly levered non-bank institutions like Bears and Lehman's played a fundamental role in significantly amplifying the crisis. Excess leverage in housing sectors such as those in the US, Ireland and Spain was incredibly damaging, and this has led to the long-lived effects we still see today, both economic and political. But we still don't have a good handle on what level of leverage is dangerously excessive for either governments, households, banks or corporates. This surely is a major challenge for the economics profession to address. As I said earlier, banks have increased capital and reduced leverage, but those such as Annette Admati still make the argument that further reduction in leverage is necessary. The banking system has not got enough capital yet. I don't necessarily agree with that, I'm just saying that's her view. In terms of government, public debt is sustainable until it's not. It is not at all clear whether there is a threshold of sustainability. We have seen crises erupt at very different levels of public debt. Public debt in Japan is currently 240% of GDP, no crisis. We've seen other countries have debt crises at considerably lower levels of debt to GDP, and the market can turn on these countries very quickly. We do know that unhedged borrowing in foreign currency significantly increased the vulnerability in terms of public debt, and the European situation highlights the issues that arise when the government doing the borrowing and the central bank are part of the same currency union but aren't the same country. On the private sector side, what are the appropriate metrics as to how much debt is too much? Corporate debt sustainability is assessed in terms of debt-to-equity ratios or serviceability. It's probably the form of debt about which we have the best understanding of sustainability. But what about household debt? Debt-to-income is commonly used, but that is dividing a stock by a flow, which is a metric which we don't use for anyone else's balance sheet. We can look at household leverage, but that is very much dependent on the value of the denominator, house prices in this case, and we know they can decline quite rapidly. Serviceability can be a useful metric, but we don't have a good sense of sustainability, at least at the aggregate level. The quality and distribution of household debt matters as well as the level. And the policy measures implemented in Australia over recent years have been aimed at improving the quality and hence sustainability of household debt. So while acknowledging that household debt is higher than Australia than many other countries, there is little to form a strong conclusion about how much is too much. How much debt is enough and how to best manage the risks are two of the large questions remaining unanswered 10 years after the GFC. So let me finish up with history never repeating. So the GFC has provided many lessons, some old, some new. Let me summarise them here. One of the main lessons was an old one, leverage matters. Leverage can turn a manageable macro event into a very hard to manage crisis. The regulatory response has been aimed at addressing this by reducing the leverage in the core of the financial system while being mindful that the risk and leverage is not excessively relocated elsewhere. The second lesson is that timely policy responses are effective, and in particular, in a crisis, go fast and go hard and don't die wondering. The third lesson is that the plumbing can sometimes really matter. Keep the credit pipes flowing. Target policy responses and interventions are effective. Use budget pricing where these interventions are priced to work in bad times but are not needed in the good times. But the last one there, the question of how much debt is enough and how much is too much remains unresolved. So the lessons learned from the GFC will be useful, provided they are not forgotten, but there will be new challenges ahead and the sources of the next crisis will probably be different. So history does not repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Thanks. Finish there.
Guy, thanks for such a timely and very topical speech. I think you might have set a record there by somehow getting the plumbing of the banking system wrapped up in album covers as well, unless you've delivered something similar before.
I have, okay.
Well, I thought it might have been a first, but it wasn't. So, look, Guy's agreed to answer some questions from the floor. So we've got two microphones. There's one here and there's one just here. So if asking a question, can you please state your name and your affiliation and keep your question short and to a point?
Paul Bloxham, HSBC. Thanks, Guy, for those remarks. They were great. You spoke about the idea that the RBA still got flexibility and the idea that the RBA could still cut the policy rate if they needed to. For the last few years, we've had, or for a number of years now, we've had inflation that's been below the Reserve Bank's, the middle of the Reserve Bank's target band. And the argument, one of the arguments for not further cutting interest rates has been that the RBA has a three-pronged mandate, including the welfare of the Australian people. And that's been one of the reasons that's been put forward for not easing policy further. Household debt was rising quickly, the housing market was inflating, and the concern was that over-leverage might be a challenge. Now, the housing market is cooling and housing credit growth is slowing down. Has that changed, and how should we think about the inflation target and the RBA's inflation targeting mandate relative to that third mandate of the welfare of the Australian people in terms of thinking about the policy setting going forward?
Okay. I suppose I would look and say where do we, you know, it's still, the reaction function is pretty much the same, which is where do we expect the economy and the real economy and inflation to be in a couple of years' time, and the forecast we put out a few weeks back have inflation, you know, increasing and unemployment, well, unemployment's five now. I mean, I think, and to your point, actually, if you go back 2 years ago and said unemployment's going to be five, inflation's going to be, well, two or a fraction below, GDP growth is 3.5, would you, you know, what would your policy setting be? And you'd probably say keep policy unchanged. So if that was my expectation back then, which was around about what it was, then that says that's what the policy conclusion would have got to. So moving forward to today, we've got unemployment at 5 and we think it's going lower. We've got wages picking up, albeit gradually, and inflation's a bit low but expected to pick up as wages pick up. Then that still leaves me with roughly the same reaction function and roughly the same reaction.
So the additional piece of information we got yesterday, of course, was that the GDP number surprised.
You get
to
ask multiple questions. you can, but... I thought that was Mr. Robertson's bailiwick.
Sure.
Anyway, keep going. Sorry, go ahead.
The additional bit of information we got yesterday was the downside surprise to GDP, of course, and the fact that there was a weaker consumption growth than was generally expected. So that bit of the story you just described, I guess, has come out differently to the way the RBA was forecasting as recently as the last set of numbers. How has that affected the view at this stage?
Yeah, so as you say, consumption was weaker than expected. Everything else is pretty much as expected. So I think it's just a question of seeing how that goes. So, and we'll see how that goes over the next few months and reassess accordingly. Mr. Gillespie.
Hi, Guy. Yeah, Brick Gillespie from Ellerston Capital. So I'll ask a question about the US and let you relax a little bit, I guess.
I'm trying to just...
So, looking at where the next problem is going to come from, we've had Yellen out talking about leveraged loans. We've had Powell out talking about corporate debt being quite normal for this stage of the cycle and not a concern. But there is an awful lot of focus on the US corporate debt picture. Investment-grade debt has risen 100% over the last decade. Corporate debt in emerging markets has risen 300%. So this is quite what we would have expected after 10 years of QE and zero interest rates. People have run to every corner of the world chasing yield. Haven't they just fanned another bubble again with low interest rates, and we're just about to watch another credit bubble burst, which this time is going to be in the corporate sector?
It's not obvious. I mean, it comes back to the question I had there at the end there, how much is enough? It's not obvious. I mean, the U.S., as you said, the U.S. debt, corporate debt levels, have gone up. Not obvious to me that they're excessive. Leverage loans have gone up. They're actually still pretty small in the overall scheme of things. I mean, it may be a problem for those who have bought them. I think one interesting thing to think on that, so leverage, came back to something I said during the talk, so leverage loans are not on the books of the banks, at least not unless it did what the aforementioned UBS did and sold them out one end and bought them in the other. But assuming that hasn't happened, and I don't think it has, then it's on the book of asset managers like yourself, and then it's partly a question of, not saying you guys have them, but it's partly a question of what, you know, that's from a financial intermediation, in terms of keeping credit flowing, that's a good thing, or a better thing at least, in that if there is a problem there and it's sitting on the books of the asset managers rather than on the books of the core banking system, then that may help keep intermediation flowing. So that's one difference now compared to what it was 10 years ago. That's probably also true for emerging market debt. It's sitting on the books of asset managers and the like and not on the books of the banks. And so that does, I think, have implications as to if something goes wrong with that, how things might unfold and how that might actually affect economic outcomes. So, you know, the debt's gone up, that's true, but it's actually being held by different people now than what it would have been a decade or so ago, and that potentially has pretty important implications for how they might actually play out should things actually go bad. Not that I'm necessarily expecting them to do so.
Thanks.
Go, Rory, and anybody. Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Guy, you mentioned my name. I thought it was sort of like a cry for help. You wanted me to ask a question. So one of the lessons, I think the fourth lesson of the from the GFC is keep the credit flowing.
Yeah.
The latest Australian housing credit number, I think for October, was 0.3.
Yeah.
And except for some crazy wiggle in 1984, that's the weakest reading in 40 years. How do you keep the credit flowing? The standard way to do it is to cut interest rates, and that's you know, been off the table recently. Is it credible to sort of watch the Australian house prices, you know, trend lower, housing credit growth trend lower, and keep saying that the next move in rates is up? Is there any other way to sort of keep the credit flowing? Is there any way?
I mean, the credits, we don't lend, banks lend, and I think that's relevant here in that. So the price of new credit is actually sort of roughly going down, as best as we can tell. Institutions, let me back up. There's a few things going on. One, so lending to owner-occupiers is growing about 5 to 6% at the moment. Lending to investors is flat. And that gives you the number that you just said. So there are some parts of the household sector which are still borrowing. Lending by the major banks is slowed to the lowest it's been in a long time. Lending by the non-major banks is as fast as it's been in a long time. Now, one's a bit bigger than the other, that's true, but again, the aggregate is what the net outcome of all of that is. So the credit is still flowing. It's flowing at a slower rate at the moment, but that's something we are paying close attention to see whether or not it slows further. At the moment, as I said, it's growing to owner-occupiers at about 5 to 6%, which is... Yeah, that's okay. That's not a satisfactory enough rate of growth for credit. So it's a question of where it goes from here. That's a function as much of the bank's willingness to lend as much as anything else. As I said, the price for new borrowing is sort of flat to down, not up. So it's not so much an issue of the price. It seems to be an issue of the willingness to lend. There's also an issue on the willingness to borrow. One of the reasons why I think investor borrowing isn't that strong at the moment, part of it's is on the supply side, but part of it's on the demand side. When prices are falling, not surprisingly, investors don't rush in to buy. As well, like I was talking about liquidity provision, market making, sorry, in terms of financial markets back earlier, is that when prices are falling, people tend not to want to rush out and catch a falling knife. So there'll be a period where prices are falling and investors aren't going to rush in and buy until they actually think that the next movement in price is likely to be up rather than down. So I suspect that's some part of the dynamics which is playing out at the moment as well. So is it a risk? Yeah, it's a risk. Is it something we're paying attention to? Yeah. I think the other thing to point out is that we, as best as I can tell, we're trying to check that this is actually true. What we haven't really seen anywhere in the world is a decent fall in house prices in two capital cities at the same time as unemployment is going down and the economy is growing along at a reasonable pace. Nearly all other house price falls have occurred in environments where there's been, you know, recessions and the like. This is, to some extent, uncharted territory in seeing these sort of dynamic play out in an environment where, you know, as of now at least, the macro economy is travelling at a reasonable pace, and you know, something we expect to continue to do so. And you know, so that's certainly something we're paying close attention to. Yeah, absolutely, and it's certainly a risk to the outlook.
There's a perception out there that macro pru caused this. It was called, is, you know, the tightening of macro pru is sort of has driven the sort of downtrend in credit growth, downtrend in house prices, and there's a perception that if only macro pru were eased, they could stabilise things. But is there any real scope for APRA to announce, well, grow investor credit 10% plus, you know, go crazy with interest-only loans more than 30% of your flow? Like, is there any real scope for an easing of macro pru to stabilise this?
So I talked about this at a event like about 3 weeks ago. And so, yes, the slowing in credit did have absolutely something to do with the tightening up in lending standards. It's been going on for 3 or 4 years. That's not new. It's been going on for a while. The investor lending cap came in 2015. It's actually off for most lenders now. So that actually isn't in place for a large number of the lenders out there now. So I don't know how APRA is going to move on other things, but in the end, if the banks have a reduced appetite for lend for other reasons, then that's a different set of circumstances. But that's true of some, but not all banks. There's a number of smaller banks out there which have an increased appetite to lend, at least as reflected in the growth of their lending book. So it's not across the board. And so, as I said, there are some banks whose books are growing at 10% at the moment. There are some banks whose books are barely growing at the moment.
Thanks very much.
Hi, Guy. This is Swati from Reuters. I have two questions, if I can, please. First is a follow-up on the housing prices. At what point will it become a concern for the RBA? I mean, we do know that house prices have doubled between 2008 and 2016, so like a 10% fall is fine, and that was something regulators, in fact, wanted. But what is that point where it starts becoming a concern? And second question is, since yesterday's GDP data, we've seen a change in OIS pricing as well as interbank futures, which was earlier pricing in a 40% chance of a hike next year. Now it's pricing a small chance of a cut. Do you agree with that market pricing?
Market pricing is what the market... I don't know, ask this. This is the market, right? On the house price point, first of all, house price falls were not the target of the regulator. I think that's an important point to make. So I wouldn't agree with the way you characterise that. Addressing the quality of the credit was the primary goal. And again, I talked about this a few weeks back. So it's not something which was desired or engineered, the house price falls, I mean, by the regulatory actions. I'm not saying it's not a consequence of them, but it wasn't the goal by any means. And as you point out, house prices did indeed double in... Also, I'd like to point out, there are other parts of the country besides Sydney and Melbourne. I know that's often forgotten, but there are other parts. Although, with Mr. Farber up there, I should note that, yes, WA house prices are still falling, have been going for quite a while. But there are other parts of the country. House prices are up 10% in Hobart over the past year. They're up in Canberra. They're up in Mr. Sutcher, my old hometown of Adelaide as well. So there you go. There are other places where prices are rising. But as you said, here in Sydney, they did double, not, you know, 100% rise over 8 years. They're down 10%. So they're, as of today, or as of, sorry, the last observation we had, which was November now, they're back to where they were in September 2016. Here in Sydney. In Melbourne, they're back to where they were in March 2017. And Melbourne's house prices, so I thought someone would ask this, so I've got all the numbers here. that Melbourne's house prices went up to the 2017, they doubled over a slightly longer period than Sydney, but only about a year longer than Sydney, and they're down 6% now. So I do think it's worth keeping some perspective around that. They are still falling, and so it is something, as I said in answering Rory's question, that is something you absolutely got to we're paying attention to, both the lending side and in terms of what's happening on the price side and what that might actually and what impact that may or may not have on the economy. As I said, it's an interesting environment we've got, where we've got the unemployment rate's been coming down. The economy is growing at a reasonable pace. That's not an environment we've seen really anywhere else before, where house prices are falling. It's sort of, as I said, it's somewhat uncharted territory, and sort of seeing how that might play out. Justin.
Thanks. I just want to ask about wealth effects.
Yeah.
As someone that's a bit sceptical about the strength of them, but I just want to know the bank's view, and you've got this fancy new, well, it's not that new now, team called Martin or something like that, which does some modelling, and I'm sure they've been running the numbers. I'm sure if you run kind of the numbers on wealth effects, they might be telling you something a bit scary in a forward-looking sense, but is that right? Or how are you guys thinking about the potential here for kind of negative wealth effects? Or are you a bit more circumspect about it these days, you know, versus, say, 2003, 2004?
Yeah, I think it's a good question and sort of first order question. I mean, part of the issue is, as we had a doubling in house prices, as I just said in answering Swati's question, and it's not clear how much of an impact it seemed to have had some impact, but not that large an impact. It's also not clear. So given we had such a large run up and then a fall, so you know what matters is how much you're. Let me step back. Personally, and this is a personal view, not necessarily that of the institution as a whole, I always have a little bit of trouble with housing as wealth, because I regard it more as consumption, because I actually live in it. And that's mostly what I'm after. And that's relevant, though, when it comes to wealth effects. Is if I bought a place to live in, so if I bought at the peak of the market, I might be pretty pissed off that I bought at the peak of the market. If I'd waited a year later, I could have bought it cheaper. But I've still bought a place to live in, and that's what I'm doing. I'm living in it. And so how much of that translates into wealth is not so clear. But that aside, to the extent that the modelling tells you anything, is that the wealth effects are generally small. But they're also, but as I said, it's also hard. We don't have many episodes like we've got at the moment as well, on which to base it. But it would say that they're potentially a risk and certainly something we should be paying attention to. But it's actually pretty uncertain. So, I still think we've got to see how that plays out. I think a potentially more direct channel is actually if housing turnover is really low, which it is, not putting aside house prices. When people buy a new house, they often buy stuff to stick in the house. Then the fact that housing turnover is low, to some extent to me, that would be more likely to have a more direct effect on consumption necessarily than the wealth itself. Because you mentioned the earlier episode, when it went to 03, 04, 02, 03, whatever. So back then, one difference between then and now is that as best as we can measure it, there was housing equity withdrawal back then. At the moment, and for the last number of years, there's been large housing equity injection. So that dynamic is quite different this time around than it was back in the early to mid 2000s.
Just go this side and then this side, and that's enough.
Matt Cranston from the Financial Review. The RBA is constantly being able to pull the levers of the economy from the top down. I just wondered if you could work it from the bottom up. What sort of piece of advice would you give, say, the 6.5 million home mortgage holders in Australia about what they should do in preparation for the coming years? Would you say to them, maybe adjust your savings rate, ask for more of a pay rise, spend less, spend more? What would be the ultimate thing you would like to see from the bottom up?
I mean, ultimately, I think it's probably, as long as the banks have done decent piece of lending, they've probably got a mortgage they can actually afford, in which case, keep affording your mortgage. I mean, the main thing to do is not lose your job, I think, because that that actually is the thing which makes it hardest to pay back your mortgage. I mean, I say that in all seriousness. If you've got a job, you can probably afford your mortgage as long as both you and the bank were sensible in the decision you took. So, you know, if you've got it, that's the main thing to do, and our main job is to make sure that the economy continues at a reasonable pace with a low level of unemployment. That's going to be the thing which allows most people out there who have got a mortgage to continue to handle that mortgage. So, you know, presumably you took a mortgage out which you could afford. If you could afford it then, you almost certainly can still afford it today. That's, I mean, in most cases, not absolutely every case. But as I said, the main thing for us to do is to make sure that the macro environment remains positive, and in that positive macro environment, most people are going to be able to continue to pay back or to manage their mortgage just as they are doing currently.
So you don't think you should be telling everyone that they should be asking for a pay rise?
I'm sure everyone would like a pay rise. And Phil has talked about this a lot, we have a low level of wage growth at the moment, and that's been true for a while. And he talked about this at some length a few weeks back. And for us to be able to fulfil goal of getting inflation a bit higher, that's going to need a higher level of wage growth than we see at the moment. That's what we've got in our forecast. We need that pickup of wage inflation to occur to be able to, for us to be able to deliver on the inflation side of our mandate. Part of helping to achieve that is also, as I said earlier, a second ago, sorry, is to keep the macroeconomy going in a decent place, to keep the unemployment rate at the sort of level it is or lower or trending down, to generate those sort of wage pressures.
So, last two is
to you. Hi, thank you. Sarah Hunter from BIS Oxford Economics. I'll keep that in mind. Try and keep my job to help make your job that bit easier. I wanted to actually go back to the last sort of key lesson that you drew from the global financial crisis, that history never repeats itself and the next pocket of risk is going to show up somewhere else to what we've seen in the past. I just wondered how much attention you and the RBA were giving to emerging markets as a potentially a source of risk. So obviously the last crisis came out of the US. Are you looking at China in particular and their financial system and position as a potential source of risk for the next crisis?
Yes, and we've identified that as a potential. It's been around about our number one source of risk now for, three or four years. So yes, is the answer to that question. Have we paying a lot of attention to China and its financial sector developments? Yes, I was there last week. I spent the whole of last week there paying exactly attention to that point. That was the main issue on the agenda. So, yeah, that's something we have been concerned about for a long time, been paying a lot of attention to for a long time, continue to pay a lot of attention to, devote a decently large amount of resources as to what's going on in China. I think elsewhere in this region, though, on the EM debt more generally, things seem to be going okay. Most of the other EM countries which have issues, I think, and we've said this in a number of our publications, a decently large number of them are idiosyncratic issues and not so much a general statement. I think by and large the EM world, going back, we had a EM debt crisis. We've had a few of them before, but in this region at least, the memories of 97 and 98 are very much burned still in people's memories. That's one thing they haven't forgotten in this region, and they have learnt the lessons from that and have done a lot, I think, to increase their resiliency, and that's indeed what we're seeing playing out in this part of the world, not necessarily in all parts of the world, but in this part of the world over the last year or two.
Thank you. Guy, we've got two former chairmen
and life
members of the ABE, so if we can go to Rob and Bill, and that is definitely the last two.
I'll give Bill the last word.
One here too.
Rob Henderson from the Independent Economist Group, that'll be my hat for tonight, Guy. I was thinking about your great caricature of what happened during the GFC. And one of the things that you mentioned, of course, was the impact of fiscal policy, so the ability of the government to stimulate the economy and to provide a guarantee for the banks. And that depended on a very strong sovereign position. Now, my question's about sovereign risk, because I was driving in the car today and I happened to hear Chris Bowen on the radio, and he brought up the term sovereign risk in regard to the government's divestiture proposals for the energy industry. And just recently also we've had the term sovereign risk used in regard to the potential for revisiting some of the licences for the Adani mine, the Adani coal mine in North Queensland. So I guess my question is, does the RBA think of those latter two types of issues as sovereign risk? And or is it more the risk of some government intervention? And secondly, do those sorts of risks actually, are they large enough to be considered in your scenario building for the future in terms of looking at the investment outlook for the Australian economy or not? So I'd just be interested in how
I'm not going to go down the politics, Rob, but what I was talking about is, in my talk today, is does the government's balance sheet have the capacity to, if necessary, in a crisis, do roughly what it did back in 08, 09, and I think the answer to that question is yes. There is fiscal space for that sort of fiscal policy response, should it be necessary if similar situation. I really hope this doesn't happen, but should it actually arise again in the future?
Stephen. Thanks, Stephen. Bill Evans from Westpac. Deputy Governor, I'm just interested in your assessment as to how this housing cycle might play out on this occasion. You know, if we look at the last three times we've had marked falls in house prices in 11, 12 and 07, 08 and 89, 91, on each occasion affordability got stretched, partly because prices went up, partly because rates went up. And then to restore equilibrium, affordability had to be restored. And on each of those occasions, it really happened through big rate cuts. So in 89, 91, the cash rate fell from 17 to 8.5. And in 07, 08, from 7.25 to 3. And then in 11, 12, from 4.75 to 3. This time, the adjustment to affordability is going to really be on prices, because there's very little scope to provide those sorts of rate cuts. So do you think it'll be a much more drawn-out process this time? And then the final problem is, you mentioned Perth. So Perth has actually restored affordability after 4 years of falling prices. But in the last 6 months, prices have fallen sharply in Perth, and that looks like a credit supply story as well. So even if you get to a level of affordability where people want to come back into the market, if the supply of credit is restricted, it could further extend the process. So without that interest rate mechanism and with the credit restriction, do you think it's reasonable to think that this particular cycle will last a lot longer before we reach that level of affordability that will attract people back into the market? Or do you think it'll be like similar cycles where they've recovered fairly quickly?
I don't know, Bill. I mean, that's what I'm saying. This is a different set of circumstances from what we've seen before, partly for some of the reasons that you just mentioned. Affordability, I would have thought the main way you get things affordable is actually the price falls. That is what affordability is mostly about, is whether you can afford to pay for the asset. But as you say, there are other things at play at the moment, which is the appetite of the banks to lend. That's not a price story, that's a quantity story. And price doesn't solve that story. Price doesn't necessarily solve that problem. That's not going to restore appetite to lend, I don't think. I mean, you work at a bank, you probably know better than I. As to how the decision-making around those restrictions on credit supply, which, as I said, is primarily coming through the major banks, not through the rest of the banking system. They're a very large chunk of the market, obviously. So it's a different set of dynamics than what we've seen in the past, as you described, and that I think makes it something which is not so easy to work out exactly how it's going to play out. And as I said, in partly in answering, I think Rory's question or Swati's question, is that it's as much so the dynamics are different. I think there's also an issue of how that translates into the macro economy as well, because those circumstances are different than what we've seen in the past too. So, yep, I think there are a number of uncertainties around there at the moment, including, as I said, as you were talking about, on the supply of credit, and it's not entirely clear how that resolves itself in the near future too. So, yep, it's a new set of I think it's quite different from the sort of the episodes that you described a minute ago. This episode is different from that, which makes having a strong idea as to how exactly it's going to resolve also different. But I suppose the other point I would come back to, which I mentioned earlier, is that we're entering this episode with a much different macroeconomic environment than we did in those previous episodes. The first one was a large recession. Early 90s one was a large recession. 07-08 was the GFC, which I've been talking about today. So that's a different set of macro circumstances that preceded those episodes and what we've got now, where, as I said, at the moment at least, over the last year we've had a decline in unemployment, we've got an economy growing above trend. That's a different set of circumstances. How that plays out, I think, is really is one of the key uncertainties around at the moment.
Thanks.
Please thank Guy again.